Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast ARMv8-A, Meet the Experts, a tour of the new GIC V3 architecture. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, with today's speakers, Chris Shore and Martin Weidman of ARM. I'd like to more formally introduce our speakers before we begin, starting with Chris Shore, who is a training manager at ARM, where he has been for more than 14 years, training ARM's customers and end users all over the world. He's taught and addressed conferences on every continent except Antarctica, where opportunities are limited, but that's surely only a matter of time. Chris has lived in Cambridge for the past 31 years and is proud to be part of the ongoing Cambridge phenomenon. He holds an MA in computer science from Cambridge University and is a chartered engineer. Martin Weidman is a principal applications engineer in ARM's Partner Enablement Group. He's worked at ARM for 10 years, supporting partners on a range of ARM technologies, and currently he concentrates on supporting ARMv8-A, TrustZone, and GIC V3. Now, before we begin, there are a few housekeeping items to address, starting with the features of your viewing console. The Enlarge Slides button will maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. Second, the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you prefer to follow along with a hard copy. Next, the Forward to a Friend button enables you to send an email that includes a registration link to this eCast so that friends and colleagues can also attend. The Ask a Question text box allows you to participate in the event by simply typing your question into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while reviewing the material. We'll address as many of these questions as possible during the closing Q&A, and also if you have questions regarding the eCast operation itself, submit those as well, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. One final note before we begin is a reminder that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. Now to hand it off to our first speaker, Chris, take it away.
Brandon, thank you very much. If I just carry on that introduction just by showing you exactly what we look like. Martin and I are sitting here in a room in ARM's headquarters in Cambridge in the UK. Delighted to be online with you. I'm the good-looking guy on the left, and Martin is the even better-looking guy on the right. As Brandon says, I've been around at ARM for just about nearly 16 years now, and Martin for over 10. We both work in what's called the Partner Enablement Group, which is all about helping ARM's customers and users all over the world achieve great things and better things with ARM technology. I've been looking after ARM training for several years now, and Martin is to do with primarily with customer support, although for the last few months he's been spending 50% of his time with the architecture group, and as part of that activity has actually been involved in writing generating the specification for GIC V3, the next version of ARM's generic interrupt control architecture, and the supporting documentation that goes with that. So Martin is fantastically qualified to be helping us learn a little bit more about that. Just before I hand over to Martin, just let me give you a bit of background about the group that we both work for. This is ARM Partner Enablement Group, based out of Cambridge in the UK, as well as several other support sites worldwide. We provide training, documentation, and also support and maintenance and some other assistance services. If you want to follow up after today's webinar, there's lots of documentation on the website. If you're new to ARM, you'll find an awful lot to interest you there. If you just want to head for the particular documentation about the interrupt controller architecture that we're talking about today, head for infocenter.arm.com, look under the ARM architecture heading on the left-hand side, and follow the links from there. You will find that you'll need to you'll need to sign a little click-through license to get hold of that. That's not because the document is confidential. It's simply that we prefer to track who has access to some of our latest documentation. So do go and have a look at that and do download it and do follow up afterwards if you want to. I said Martin and I are based in Cambridge, which is where we are, right in the middle of the diagram there. That's ARM's headquarters. ARM has well over 1,000 people on campus right here, but there are a lot of ARM staff elsewhere in the world. We have over 3,000 worldwide. And the other locations that you can see highlighted on that map of the world are the other support locations that we have. So there will be one near to you. The ones in red are our major support locations, and that's Cambridge in the middle, Shanghai in China on the right-hand side, and Austin, Texas on the left-hand side. ARM Active Assist is a project review service that PEG offers, or the Enablement Group offers, to anyone designing ARM silicon. And also, right on the right-hand side of that, these days we offer it to anyone who's designing and optimizing software using the Neon SIMD multimedia technology. So if you're designing an SoC or a device using ARM technology, one of the things that we can come in, we can offer you, is to come in and review your RTL, review your design before you commit to tape out. We can also help you with the implementation, help you with the physical layout and achieving your design goals with that. And then, say, after implementation, after tape out, we can come in and help you optimize your software. If that's something you're interested in, it's a product that I look after these days. So do please feel free to contact me directly and ask me all about that. You'll find more information on the website too. If I can also just take a minute of your time to highlight some new developments in ARM training. If you were with us about 2 or 3 months ago when Martin and I did the previous seminar in this series on V8, I highlighted the fact that we had three methods now of delivering training, and they were private training, public training, and live remote. You can see details of all of those on the slide here. Private courses, they're for a single customer, single class, face-to-face delivery. The middle one, public courses, they are scheduled at our regional offices, and anyone is welcome to register for those and attend. And you can find the schedule published on the website. Live remote is courses that you can commission for you or your team, delivered from rooms like the one Martin and I are in at the moment, live over WebEx technology, so we can get distributed teams in, and we can deliver in pretty much any location at pretty much any time. But the new development that I'd like to highlight to you today is we're starting, small steps, but we are starting to put some of our training content online in on-demand format. So if you want to go after we finish today, just click on the fourth tab on our training page at arm.com/training. You'll find what is currently a relatively small offering, but an offering that's going to grow over time. And I'd love to have your feedback on what you'd like to see on that page. So if the course you would really like to view is not there, please do get in touch and tell us what you'd like to see on that page. But all of those are available for on-demand watching anywhere in the world, any time zone, any time you like. You can click on the links and just go ahead and purchase with a credit card directly on the site. They're all timed for about an hour long, and they're all reasonably priced for individual purchase. So please do tell us what you want to see on that page. Okay, enough of me. I'm going to hand over now to Martin. He's going to take us through the next 40 minutes or so, a tour of the developments in ARM's generic interrupt controller architecture and GIC version 3 is his subject for today. Here comes Martin.
Thanks for the introduction, Chris. My name is Martin Weitman. I'm a principal engineer in ARM's support group. I'm based here with Chris in Cambridge. I've been at ARM for about 11 years, and for the last few months I've been working about half my time on the GIC specification and some of the supporting materials. The aim for today is to introduce the GIC architecture and to talk about the new features in GIC version 3 and also to talk a little bit about GIC version 4. So before we talk about GIC version 3, which is the main subject of the day, I would like to spend just 2 slides giving some background information. Not everybody is going to be that familiar with the GIC architecture, so it is it's worth giving some background information. So GIC stands for Generic Interrupt Controller Architecture, and like the ARM architecture, it's primarily a functional specification. So it doesn't describe how you implement an implement controller. it describes the programmer's model and the functional model of the interrupt controller. So it defines, for example, what registers the interrupt controller has, what those registers are for, how software interacts with the interrupt controller, both to program it up and then to later deal with interrupts. The GIC architecture is very much designed for multi-core and multi-processor systems where we have a single interrupt controller shared across potentially quite a large number of cores. Why do we have a generic interrupt controller architecture? Well, the argument here is that pretty much every chip is going to need an interrupt controller. ARM processors only have two interrupt signal inputs, so we're going to have far more interrupt sources than that. We will need an interrupt controller. Why does ARM think a standard or a generic interrupt controller is a good idea? Essentially, to make the software story simpler, particularly if you're working in, say, OS development, you don't want to have to write multiple drivers for multiple different interrupt controllers on different chips, particularly given that the interrupt controller is unlikely to be a major differentiating factor between those chips. So it makes sense for everybody, both the software and the hardware people, to agree on a standard. And that's why a few years ago, ARM introduced the GIC architecture. This talk is about GIC version 3. Obviously, that means there was a GIC version 1 and a GIC version 2 before that. I'm not going to talk about GIC version 1. That's far enough away in time now that it's not that interesting. But I would like to talk a little bit about GIC version 2, only to put what changes in GIC version 3 into some kind of perspective. So GIC version 2, you'll find used with most of ARM's Cortex-A processors at the moment. It supports up to 8 connected cores. Now that works quite well in mobile. Say you have a big-little system with up to 2 processors, each with 4 cores. That nicely fits with the architecture where we can have up to 8 cores in total. It also supports 1,020 interrupt sources. Again, that works pretty well in mobile where we don't have that many interrupt sources in total. Each one of those interrupt sources has an 8-bit priority value. And as well as peripheral interrupts, GIC version 2, GIC version 1 support software-generated interrupts. These are interrupts generated by software writing to a register, and they're used for things like IPIs and operating systems. GIC version 2 also supported ARM's TrustZone and virtualization extensions, so you can have secure and non-secure interrupts. You can have physical and virtual interrupts. ARM offers an implementation of GIC version 2 that's called the CoreLink GIC 400. Now, with that information in mind, let's move on to talk about GIC version 3. GIC version 2, 8 cores. GIC version 3, it lifts that limit, and we can have many more than 8 cores. Why do we need this? Well, in mobile, 8 cores is still probably enough for many designs, but particularly when you go away from mobile, if we talk about servers or networking, it's already likely that you'll want to have more than 8 cores. If you want to have all of those cores in a single system, it really does help to have one interrupt controller shared by all those cores. GIC version 3 also vastly increases the interrupt ID space. Previously, we had up to 1,020 interrupt IDs. Now we can have a 24-bit interrupt ID, giving us a much larger range of interrupt IDs. Now, a side effect of having many more IDs is we need to make some changes about how those interrupts go to the interrupt controller. And one of the other features we add is message-based interrupt support. We'll talk about that in a little while. We have an enhanced security model to better fit ARC64 in ARM V8. But also, we need to be aware that not all software will have been written for GIC version 3. We won't always be able to port our software in time. So GIC version 3 does offer a legacy mode, giving backwards compatibility. As with GIC version 2, ARM does offer an implementation of the GIC version 3 architecture. This is called CoreLink GIC 500. It supports up to 128 cores. All partners are also able to take the specification and implement their own version of the GIC if they wish. Now, Chris mentioned that the Git version 3 specification went online a few days ago. Well, actually, that document doesn't just cover version 3, it also covers version 4. And what version 4 adds above and beyond version 3 is the ability to directly inject virtual interrupts. And we'll talk about that at the very end of the presentation. Now, for the rest of at least my slides, we're pretty much going to use the slide we just saw as an agenda. So I'm not going to talk about those features which have stayed the same, assuming it's some familiarity with Git version 2. I'm going to concentrate very much on those bullets which are new in version 3. We're going to start off by looking at the register interface and the security model. We'll move on to looking at those features for larger systems, the increased core count, the increased ID width. We'll look very briefly at the legacy operation. And as I mentioned, we'll finish up by looking at the Git v4 virtualization changes. So let's start by looking at the system register interface. Traditionally, in Git versions 1 and 2, all the Git registers were memory mapped. That meant when you were programming an interrupt or handling an interrupt, load store instructions were used to communicate with the interrupt controller. Now that's still true in version 3 for many of the interrupt controller registers, so particularly for configuring the interrupt sources, things like the priority settings, they are still mostly in memory mapped registers. But those registers used for handling interrupts, so things you interact most commonly with in the interrupt handler code, they can now be system registers, which means in software, rather than load and store, we use MSR and MRS instructions. Now, in order for these to be system registers rather than memory mapped, we do need support for those registers to be built into the cores the interrupt controller is going to connect to. So the individual cores need to implement a GIC CPU interface. ARM's Cortex processors, the A53, A57, and the A72, they all implement the required logic for you to have the system register interface if you have a GIC v3 implementation in your system. That's fine, but why make this change? What's the advantage of having a system register interface? Well, this feature is based on feedback from a lot of our partners, particularly the OS vendors, who said that it is an advantage to them to have these system register interfaces, these particularly these registers which are used quite intensively by code in handlers, because it removes the uncertainty of where those registers are going to be. They aren't going to be at different addresses and different systems. And it can, in some implementations, give you a more reliable, more deterministic set of timings than going through every memory interface. Moving on to looking at security and group. So the GIC architecture supports trust zones, so we have the idea of secure and non-secure interrupts. In GIC version 2, we talked about group 0, secure interrupts, group 1, non-secure interrupts. Now, we changed that a little bit in GIC version 3. We now have three groups, group 0, secure group 1, non-secure group 1. Why make this change? Well, this change is very much about fitting in with other changes that are happening in the ARM architecture, specifically how ARC64 changes the security and privilege model. So traditionally in V7, we had something called monitor mode. Monitor mode is where the secure monitor software executed, providing the gatekeeper functionality between the two security states on the processor. Now, monitor mode in V7 is the same level of privilege as the secure privilege mode. So the secure monitor software is the same level of privilege in V7 as the trusted OS. If we move forward to ARM V8 and ARC64, that now changes. We now have EL3, where the secure monitor and often the firmware execute, but the secure OS executes at secure EL1, so a lower level of privilege. The reason we now have these three groups is to match that split in privilege. We still have non-secure group 1 interrupts at the bottom. Typically, these are going to be the physical interrupts, either for the rich OS, think Linux here, or the hypervisor. But on the secure side, we split the secure interrupts in two. Group 0 interrupts are things we expect to be handled at EL3, either by the secure monitor or possibly more likely by any firmware code running at EL0, while any interrupts for the secure OS would be marked as secure group 1. So this lets us differentiate between interrupts for EL3 and interrupts for EL1, secure or non-secure. Group 0 interrupts, these are always FIQs. Group 1 interrupts are a little bit more interesting. Now that the CPU interface is part of the processor, it means that we can be a little bit more intelligent in how we use the processor exceptions. Remember, ARM V8 and ARM V7 have the FIQ exception and the IRQ exception. Now, in GIC V2, secure interrupts are FIQs, non-secure interrupts are IRQs. In GIC V3, FIQ becomes either an interrupt for EL3 or an interrupt for the non-current security state. And that might make a little bit more sense when we move on to the next slide. So if we start off on the right-hand side, at the top right, a secure group 1 interrupt, if it occurs while we're in secure state, will be signaled as an IRQ, and we expect to deal with that IRQ in the trusted OS. If we get a non-secure group 1 interrupt, that's an interrupt for the other security state, and that will get signaled as an FIQ. Typically, but not always, we'd have that routed to EL3. EL3 would perform the world switch. We'd go back into non-secure state, and then that non-secure group 1 interrupt becomes an IRQ dealt with by the rich OS. Similarly, the other way around, if we get a non-secure group 1 interrupt while in non-secure state, that's an IRQ. A secure group 1 interrupt is an interrupt for the non-current security state. That would therefore get signaled as an FIQ. Again, go to EL3, EL3 performs the world switch, and we deal with that interrupt as an IRQ in the other security state. This potentially makes software jobs a bit easier. In GIC version 2, we potentially had to toggle the routing settings depending on which security state we're in. Now, rather than toggling the settings in the processor, we have the interrupt controller intelligently sending either IRQs or FIQs based on whether the interrupt is for the current world, current security state, or for the other security state. Now, I should stress on this slide, this is an example of how you could use the routing. You're not obliged to use it in this way. In particular, what we're showing in this example is that the non-secure interrupt causes immediate exit from the secure state into EL3, and EL3 immediately performs the world switch into non-secure state. That's not always desirable. We might, for example, want to take that FIQ initially to the secure OS, use that FIQ as a yield request, giving the trusted OS time to get into a clean state where it can hand over control. And at that point, we might use an SMC instruction to explicitly yield to the secure monitor and switch to non-secure state. So although we've got this one example of how to deal with routing, there are other models available. This just demonstrates one possible approach. Okay, so that's looking at system registers and security. What we're now going to look at is the features in GIC version 3, which are there to support larger systems. The first thing we're going to introduce is something called a redistributor. So per connected core or connected CPU, you'll have something called a redistributor, which in this diagram we've shown in blue. Now, this extra layer slips in between the existing hierarchy, so we still have the distributor at the top level, we still have the CPU interface registers, we gain this extra set of registers in the middle of our hierarchy. What do the redistributors do? They hold the settings for the private interrupts. So if anyone's used GIC version 2, they'll come across the terms PPI and STI, private peripheral interrupt and software-generated interrupt. So these are interrupt sources which are essentially private to the core. So each core can have its own copy of the settings for those interrupts. Now, those settings used to be kept in the distributor using banked registers. Rather than that, in Geek version 3, we remove the banking and instead have separate copies at different addresses of the redistributor. Again, why do we do this? Well, imagine if you had a very large design with a large number of connected cores. Private interrupts are typically going to be generated relatively close to the core that they are private to. We don't really want to have to transport that interrupt signal to the far side of the chip where our interrupt controller lives to work out the settings, its priority, its enable, only to send the interrupt back again to the core that the interrupt belongs to. What the redistributors potentially allow for is a distributed design where the redistributor logic is physically close to the CPU that it belongs to. It can then hold the settings for those private interrupts relatively close to its connected core, and therefore the travel path for those private interrupts can be kept low. You can go only to the redistributor logic, the redistributor logic would hold the settings, and then it could forward it back onto the core. We keep the interrupt and the settings close to the core they belong to. Geek version 3 offers support for many more connected cores. One of the consequences of this is we need to rethink how we target interrupts at a particular core. ARMv8 and to a limited extent ARMv7 have this concept of affinity. Affinity is a way of identifying a core in a hierarchical structure. It's made up of four 8-bit fields that look a bit like IP addresses, where if we take just one of these examples, so we take the core on the far left, this has affinity 000, and the core next to it is 0015. So, for example, these could be two cores belonging to one processor, and the bottom affinity value is identifying with cores within the processor. The next affinity value could be identifying a particular processor. The next affinity value might be identifying different chips on a single board. The next one up might be different boards in a rack. So you can use these potentially to create a hierarchical structure. Why does the Git care? Well, it cares because we have now lots of cores connected to the interrupt controller, and we need a way of saying this interrupt, this peripheral interrupt, is going to go to that core. And we need a way of identifying which core that is, and in Git version 3, we use the affinity value. In software, you can read a core's affinity value from a system register. It's called the MPIDR. And when I want to send an interrupt to core 0000, I can say that is the affinity coordinate that I write into the GIC register to say that's where the interrupt goes. Now, for the shared peripheral interrupts, I have two available models. I can say this interrupt goes to this one specific core, 000, for example, or I can say that I want it to go to any of the enabled cores connected to the interrupt controller. So I can hand over a responsibility for delivering for choosing the target of that interrupt to the interrupt controller. Now it's worth comparing this with how this worked in version 2. In GIC version 2, you could only connect a maximum of 8 cores. And the way the targeting worked for GIC version 2 was per interrupt ID, you had an 8-bit field, bit 0 corresponded to core 0, bit 1, core 1, and so on all the way up. If you set a bit, the interrupt could be delivered to that core. If you cleared a bit, it couldn't be delivered to that core. Now that means the GIC version 2 approach is actually more flexible because you can pick subsets, which you can't do in GIC version 3. Why the change? Again, it's to do with scalability. We now support potentially a very large number of connected cores to a GIC version 3 implementation. It's just not feasible in a scalable way to implement that kind of one bit per connected core per interrupt source. So instead, we move to this model of you allow the interrupt controller to choose, or you target one specific core. When you do that, you use the affinity value to identify the target. We've gained all these extra interrupt sources, I mentioned earlier that the interrupt ID goes up to 24 bits. A consequence of this is the practicality of getting the interrupts from the interrupt source, typically a peripheral, into the interrupt controller. If we have potentially millions of interrupt sources, then the traditional approach of having a single interrupt line per interrupt source becomes quite difficult to build. It's quite difficult to route those very large number of 1-bit signals and have them converge on the interrupt controller. So GIC version 3 adds support for message-based interrupts. Message-based interrupts, rather than having a dedicated wire for an interrupt, you send the interrupt as a message, usually over the main system interconnect. So rather than having dedicated wires, we reuse the existing bus to deliver the interrupt instead, and that's potentially much more scalable in large systems. It also more closely matches the model used in things like PCIe Express. Now, GIC version 2 does not have any explicit support for message-based interrupts. You could retrofit it, and ARM did provide some guidance on how to do that. It is called GIC V2M. Really, the difference here is that message-based interrupt support has been built into GIC V3 from the beginning, rather than trying to retrofit it afterwards. Okay. We have these many more interrupt IDs. We actually introduce a new type of interrupt. So traditionally, the GIC architecture has provided three interrupt types: STIs, PPIs, and SPIs, shared peripheral interrupts, private peripheral interrupts, and software-generated interrupts. Well, the new ID ranges are assigned a new interrupt type. They're called LPIs, locality-specific peripheral interrupt. Essentially, all the new IDs have been added, 8,192 upwards, are now classed as LPIs. LPIs are a little bit different to how the other interrupt sources worked. In GIC versions 1 and 2, because we had a quite constrained number of interrupt sources, only 1,000 of them roughly, it was quite practical to store all the configuration and state within the interrupt controller in registers. Now we just have many more interrupt sources. We can't in most cases, afford to allocate that many registers to store that large amount of configuration and state. So what makes LPIs different to the other interrupt sources is we store the configuration, we store the state information, not in registers, but in memory. Part of initializing a GIC V3 implementation requires software to allocate physical memory to store the configuration and state, and then to tell the interrupt controller where that memory is, and that becomes the memory belonging to the interrupt controller. The simple reason for doing this is that typically memory is going to be a lot cheaper than registers. Now, for performance reasons, it's expected that most implementations would cache that memory internally, so still a lot of particularly state information is likely to be cached within the interrupt controller, but the backing storage would be memory rather than registers. How do we target LPIs? How does an LPI get from a peripheral to a core? There are two mechanisms available. One option is, well, first I should say that LPIs must always be message-based. We don't support wire-based LPIs. So the peripheral will always have to generate a message to generate an LPI interrupt. That message can go to a redistributor. Remember what I said earlier, there's one redistributor per connected core. If you send an interrupt to redistributor number 2, that interrupt will go to the core connected to redistributor number 2. So you can have the targeting information in the peripheral. However, what we think is going to be more common is that a system will include one or more ITSs. ITS stands for Interrupt Translation Service, and it's essentially a dispatcher. It takes incoming messages and routes them to the correct destination. The ITS provides another important feature, which is it maps incoming interrupts to interrupt numbers. So when a peripheral generates a message-based interrupt, the message contains an interrupt number that it wishes to send. But that relies on us being able to program the peripheral with what interrupt ID it should send. We might have two peripherals, say a UART and a timer, that both always send the value 5. Well, we don't want them both to appear as the same interrupt. That would be confusing for software. So we need some way of differentiating a 5 when it comes from a UART with a 5 when it comes from the timer. And that's one of the services that an ITS provides. And the best way to explain this is to take a quick example of what happens when a message-based interrupt arrives at an ITS. So we start off with the peripheral generating an interrupt message. This message provides the ITS with 2 bits of information, and we call these the device ID and the event ID. The event ID, let's start with that, that's simply the number in the message. When the peripheral generated the message, there would have been a number in there. We call that the event ID. The device ID uniquely identifies the peripheral, so it lets us distinguish between the UART and the timer. We use the device ID inside the ITS to do a lookup in the device table. The device table provides a pointer to a peripheral-specific translation table. And what that table does is give mappings between the event IDs and interrupt numbers. So having looked up in the device table, that returns us a pointer to our peripheral-specific interrupt translation table. We then use the event ID to index into the interrupt translation table. So if, say, our timer has sent event ID 5, we go and look in the entry for event ID 5, and that would tell us the interrupt number for that event, and it also gives us something called the collection ID. All LPIs that come through the ITS are grouped into collections. Collections are interrupts that all go to the same place. So we use the collection ID to index into the collection table, and that will return the target of the interrupt. So device ID identifies the source peripheral. Event ID identifies what interrupt that peripheral is sending. We use those to look up the translation. The translation gives us the interrupt number and the collection number. The collection number gives us the target of that interrupt. And at that point, the ITS can forward the interrupt to the correct place. Okay, so that's fairly straightforward, but that relies on us having all these tables already present in memory. As a software engineer, how do I populate those tables? Well, first thing to say is software does not write the ITS tables. The ITS tables are owned by the ITS. It is responsible for populating them and maintaining them. Software needs to allocate that memory, but it then leaves the memory alone. The way we populate the tables is using a command queue and by adding commands to that queue. And what we've got on this slide is a very simple command sequence for mapping an interrupt. So we're going to take the example of a timer. It has device ID 5, so that's how we uniquely identify it as that timer. And it's going to send event ID 0. We want to map event ID 0 to interrupt 8725, and we want to deliver it to redistributor number 6. So what's the command sequence? Well, first of all, we issue a mapd command. This maps a device ID to a peripheral-specific translation table. So we say mapd 5, so map device ID 5. The next number is the address, the physical address, of that translation table, and the 2 is the width of the event ID that peripheral can generate. So in this case, we've said a 2-bit event ID. In other words, our timer can generate up to 4 different uniquely identifiable events. We then issue a mapti command. This says for device ID 5, map its event code 0 to the interrupt number 8725. Remember, every peripheral might use the same set of event IDs, so that's why the map command for the interrupt also includes the device ID. we're saying it's the combination of the device ID and the event ID that map onto an interrupt number. Remember I said that LPIs that come through the ITS belong to a collection? Well, we've said collection number 3. We're mapping collection number 3 to redistributor number 6. That's what the mapc command does. And then we issue a sync command to say, I want to synchronize the changes I've made. I mentioned at the start that we have support for legacy mode, particularly for legacy software. Legacy operation can be configured separately for the two security states, but only a certain set of combinations are allowed. What this slide shows is the different combinations that are permitted. So if we start from left and go right, we can have an entirely geek-free system, so both secure and non-secure state use the new model. We can have a legacy secure state, but with a geek-free rich OS and non-secure state, or we can have an entirely legacy system. What we don't support is a legacy rich OS with a geek-free secure OS. That combination isn't allowed. And the thinking here is that we expect the rich OSs, Linux for example, to be ported relatively quickly. On the secure OS side, for some use cases, there can be a bigger delay here, partly because those OSs may need to go through security certification. So it can be more difficult for them to upgrade as quickly. Okay, lastly, I'm going to talk about the GeekVee version 4. So, as I said, this is an extension past Geek version 3. So everything we've discussed still applies, but Geek version 4 gives us one extra thing. So Geek version 4 adds direct injection of virtual interrupts. Well, what do we mean by that? Well, previously, Geek version 2, Geek version 3, the way interrupt virtualization worked is if we got an interrupt from a peripheral that was initially sent as a physical interrupt, normally taken by the hypervisor software would have to determine which interrupt it was, whether it wanted to deal with itself, whether it wanted to send it to the current virtual machine or a different virtual machine, and then go back to the interrupt controller and say, this is the virtual interrupt I want to send you instead. And that's potentially a reasonable amount of overhead if the interrupt in question is for the currently running virtual machine. What V4 lets us do is to tell the interrupt controller about those relationships in advance. So rather than waiting for the interrupt to occur and then saying, please resend like this, we can say, if this interrupt occurs, send it as this virtual interrupt. The best way to explain that is with an example. So let's take a simple sequence. Here's our system. First of all, direct injection only works with LPIs and only works through the ITS. So we have to have an ITS present. The hypervisor needs to explain the relationship between the physical interrupts and the virtual interrupts in advance to the ITS. It does this using vmapp and vmapti commands. The vmapp commands tell the ITS which physical processor a virtual processor can be scheduled to. The vmapti command explains the relationship between the physical interrupt and the virtual interrupt number. So our hypervisor would issue a series of these commands to say, okay, this virtual core can be on this physical core, these are the virtual interrupts that belong to that virtual core, and these are the physical interrupts that cause them. Some point later, we're now running the virtual machine, non-secure EL1 or non-secure EL0, and a peripheral generates an interrupt. So it's an LPI, so that's going to be a message-based interrupt. That message is going to go into the ITS. Just as before, we'll have an event ID and a device ID. Just like before, we'll do a translation. Only this time, it's going to not return a physical interrupt, it's going to return a virtual ID instead. Now, it will return a virtual ID and a virtual core ID. We use the virtual core ID to look up in the virtual PE table. PE stands for processing element. It's an ARM generic term for for a machine that implements the ARM architecture. And what that table tells us is which physical core that virtual interrupt needs to go to. So the INTF will use that information to forward the virtual interrupt to the redistributor. Now, it's possible that the virtual machine targeted by that virtual interrupt isn't currently running. It might be a different virtual machine that's running at the time. So we can also provide something called a doorbell interrupt. A doorbell interrupt is an ID that we choose as generically to say there is an interrupt for the non-currently running virtual machine. Okay. Once the interrupt arrives at the redistributor, if the virtual machine that is targeting is currently resident on the physical core, then we can send the virtual interrupt. We don't need any further software interaction. We don't have to go into the hypervisor. So we don't have the overhead of the hypervisor code. Now, it's worth saying it's still subject to the usual enable and priority checks. There's still configuration for LPIs. We're assuming they're all going to pass. On the other hand, if the virtual machine isn't resident, then we'll generate a physical interrupt instead, and that will use the doorbell interrupt ID. The hypervisor will get a generic ID to say, you got a virtual interrupt, but it wasn't for the currently running virtual machine. At this point, the hypervisor might choose to do a scheduling switch, load in the appropriate virtual machine and run that instead, allow it to deal with virtual interrupt, but it doesn't have to. It could say, well, you know, this interrupt's not very high priority, I'm going to allow the currently running virtual machine the end of its time slice, and I'll deal with this virtual interrupt at some point later. So that's how direct injection works, and that's basically the difference between V3 and V4 is the ability to have this direct injection support of virtual interrupts. Okay, that's the end of my slides. I will hand over to Brandon, and he can run the question and answer session for us.
Great. Thanks, Martin. It's a great introduction there to the GIG V3 architecture, and as Martin pointed out, that brings us into the Q&A portion of our event. We ask that you, the audience, keep those questions coming, and we'll try and fit in as many as we possibly can. Chris, there's a question here about the alphabet soup that is in engineering. Can you explain a little bit what does FIQ stand for, what it is, et cetera?
Thanks, Brandon. Yes, I can. FIQ, I get all the easy questions. I'm glad you're saving the hard ones for Martin. FIQ stands for Fast Interrupt, and it's kind of a historical name, but basically the ARM core, or the ARM architecture, defines two interrupt inputs, IRQ and FIQ, and historically FIQ was faster and higher priority than IRQ. These days there is very little to differentiate them, but they are still physically separate, and they're still vectored separately, and by convention they're often used for slightly different things. So that's all that refers to. I should just point out before we carry on that we've got a lot of questions coming in, which is really good to see. We have recorded them all, and if we don't get round to answering your question, Martin and I are going to start a forum very shortly in the next couple of days on the Connected Community, and we'll transcribe all the questions into there, and we'll start answering them. So we'll send you out a link to that very shortly. Anyway, yeah, Brandon, if you want to pick out the next question, go ahead.
Sure thing. Here's another one for you, Chris, that kind of relates to what you're just speaking about. Is there anywhere to join live remote training courses?
Live remote training. This is training delivered via WebEx, WebEx technology from ARM's headquarters, either here in Cambridge or also we do it from Austin, and we also plan to do that from Shanghai. Live remote training is generally delivered to one particular group from one particular company. So if you want to join a training course as an individual, then live remote isn't really the option for you. You need to look at our public training schedule, or the online training that we do, and look at those options there. But if you and your team in your company just want to get some, a short element of training, or get some training very urgently, then Live Remote's the thing for you, because we can schedule that very in a very agile way. And we can deliver very short segments of training in a very sort of cost-effective, time-efficient way to your team, no matter where your team is. And if your team is distributed, we can all get you together, and you can dial into the same WebEx. So hopefully that answers that question. Thanks, guys.
Before we move on to some couple questions for Martin, as Chris mentioned, there will be a link to this eCast made available on the last slide. So if you missed some of the presentation, don't worry. Martin, moving on to you, there's a question here. How does a virtual PE acknowledge the virtual FIQ or RQ?
In the same way as a physical interrupt. So one of the aims of virtualization is that it should look identical. The software shouldn't need necessarily to know that it's virtual. So your interrupt handler will read the acknowledge register, ICCIAR_EL1, at the beginning of the handler to find out which interrupt it has taken. At the end of the handler, it would write the end of the interrupt register. And if you're in a virtual machine, that will return virtual values. If you're not in a virtual machine, if you're on the hypervisor, if you're on the secure OS, it will return a physical value, a physical interrupt. So how does it acknowledge a virtual interrupt? In exactly the same way as a physical interrupt, it shouldn't need to know the difference, and you should be able to use exactly the same piece of code.
Excellent. Here's another one for you, Martin. Is it the hypervisor's job to update the ITS when it schedules a VMM on a specific core?
Sort of. So what the hypervisor describes to the ITS is it describes two things. It describes the relationship between the physical interrupt and the virtual interrupt. So this physical event goes to this virtual ID of this virtual core. And it also describes this virtual core might be running on this physical core. So when I schedule this virtual core, this is where I'm going to schedule it. This is the physical core where that virtual core could exist. The ITS doesn't know, and it doesn't need to know, if that virtual core is running or not at the time. What the ITS sends the redistributor is the virtual ID and the virtual core. It's the redistributor's job to be aware of which virtual core is currently running on the physical core. So it is the hypervisor's job to tell the interrupt controller as a whole which VMM is running, but it's not the ITS that it tells, it's the redistributor. It only needs to go back to the redistributor if it wants to change the virtual to physical mapping, or if it's going to start scheduling that virtual core somewhere else.
Another one for you, Martin. Does ARM provide an ITS itself?
Yes, but not as a standalone component. So at the beginning I mentioned CoreLink GIG 500. The CoreLink GIG 500 can optionally include an ITS. It depends on how you build it. What we don't provide is an ITS as a standalone component.
Okay, here's another question about the GIG 500 itself. How does it connect to A53, A57, A72 to allow system register access?
So that's an interesting question. Actually, the system registers themselves live within the Cortex processors. So strictly speaking, in order just to read the things like the enable registers or the control registers, they're already in the processor. That's not necessarily going to need to go and talk to GIG 500. Where the communication mostly comes in is you have an interrupt in the interrupt controller that needs to get from the controller into the core, including things like what interrupt number is it. There is an interface called the GIG stream interface with a packet protocol which has things like set, I wish to set this interrupt as pending on the CPU interface, and the CPU interface can send an acknowledge packet back to say I have now activated and acknowledged this interrupt, and then when it's finished dealing with the interrupt and you write the end of interrupt register, it will send the CPU sends another packet up going I have now finished dealing with this interrupt. So there is something called the AXI stream interface, and that's what connects the main part of the interrupt controller to the bit that lives in the processor.
Excellent. What's the purpose of collection IDs? Why wouldn't you just program the target redistributors in the IDC?
That's a good question. The argument here goes that there are two cases where you typically want to move interrupts. One might be something like load balancing. The other is, I don't really have enough work for this core to do, so I'm going to turn it off. And if I'm going to turn this core off, I need to migrate all the interrupts that target that core to target a different core instead. Now, I could issue lots of individual mapping commands for each individual interrupt source, or I can issue a relatively small number of commands to say, take all the interrupts that map that core, which are represented by the collection, and move the collection instead. And that's the argument for collections, that particularly in cases of things like when you're powering down a processor, it's often easier to move the entire collection rather than moving the individual interrupts one at a time.
Okay. Now, switching back to Chris, before we do so, I'd just like to remind the audience to keep those questions coming. We'll get to as many of them as we can here in the next few minutes. Chris, looking at the public course schedule, if there isn't a suitable course, is there training available elsewhere?
Ah, yes. Thank you for coming up with that one. Excellent question. The answer to that is absolutely yes. If you're looking at the public course schedule or indeed the online schedule and you don't see what you want, maybe the course is the wrong time for you or it's the wrong location for you or the subject you want isn't there, then there are two things you can do. One is please contact us and tell us what you're looking for. The second is you'll find the link on the training pages to third-party training partner courses because we have a network of training partners worldwide. They are literally worldwide that offer a whole range of courses. Some of them overlap with ours. Some of them use essentially the same material as ours, but they have a much wider portfolio, and some of those offer their own public training schedules and their own online offerings as well. So do go and check those out. So the partner training offering is a very important part of what we do in working through the partnership with a lot of other companies, and you can find a lot of other training out there. Thanks a lot, Brandon, for pulling that one out. That's a great question.
Sure. Actually, there's a kind of a follow-up to that. Does the same apply for on-demand web training courses?
Absolutely, yes, it does. Say we offer some. We've really just started out doing that, so the offering currently is quite small. So if you don't see what you want, A, please let us know. B, check out the websites of the training partners because you may well find exactly what you're looking for from one of our partners. So, yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Brandon.
Great. Back over to you, Martin. Let's see. Is it possible for an LPI to have insufficient message buffer memory space when the mid test isn't running?
It's an interesting question. It's interesting in the sense that the specification doesn't say how you build an ITS, just how the ITS is required to behave. It also allows you to have multiple ITSs. So just because, particularly in a large system, let's say you had a system with two PCIe root complexes, it's quite likely that you'd have one ITS per root complex, for example. The way the messages get into the ITS is as a write to a register. That's going to be transported over some sort of interconnect, just like any other a slave, which is essentially what that register is, it's going to have a limited ability to accept incoming transactions. So, yes, in theory, you could have a point where the ITS couldn't accept another incoming transaction until it had finished dealing with a previous translation request. But that would be like any other slave that you ran out of bandwidth. The transactions would just take longer. What I would say is that we would expect when you were designing your ITS for it to be built, for the people designing it to have an idea of what the level of incoming traffic is going to be, and particularly because the ITS is expect implementations to cache the translations, we would expect that not to be a problem in practice, that we would expect the implementation to be sized based on the likely demand.
Okay, time for one last question here for you, Martin. How does GIC version 3 and GIC version 4 support systems with multiple dies?
Again, it's an interesting question. I come very much from the spec side of things rather than the implementation side. So at a purely spec level, multiple chips or multiple dies is not something that we specifically call out in the way the registers. It was something we had in our mind when we were designing the specification. So things like splitting the GIC into different functional blocks, splitting out the distributor from the redistributors, moving the CPU interfaces into processors. The spec is designed to allow for these modular implementations with things like GICstream protocols in between them. The thing that joins, say, your distributor to your redistributors could be a chip-to-chip link, for example. Although you won't find a section in the manual which says this is how you do a multi-chip implementation, it was very much in the back of our minds when the spec was being designed. A lot of the rationales for the way the spec is laid out is to allow for very large systems, including multiple chips. One thing I will add, because I forgot to mention it when I was doing the slides, is we're currently working on an application note to go alongside the specification. It aims to offer a software-focused introduction to GIC v3, very much in line with the way things like the Cortex-A programmer's guides are written. It's currently being internally reviewed. We hope to have that public on the web in the next few weeks. So particularly if you're going to be writing low-level software for GIC v3, do keep an eye out for that, and we'll announce it on the community pages of the ARM website.
All right. Thanks, Martin. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. For those of you who had questions we didn't get to, we'll be sure to have ARM representatives follow up. And as Chris mentioned earlier, check out the Connected Community, and there'll be a forum there that has transcribed questions, and you can follow up. I want to thank our speakers, Martin Weidman and Chris Shore from ARM, for walking us through the GIC v3 architecture. We at Open Systems Media and ARM would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending and contributing some excellent questions today. This ECAS will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's ECAS available for download as MP3s. Thanks for attending, and have a great day.